Hello, and welcome back to PaleoCast. My name is Sophie Pollard, and you're listening to episode 161 on Notizukians with Dr. Johan Poja-Cotelieu at the Laboratoire de Géologie de Lyon. Today, we will take a look at the terrestrial crocodilomorph suborder Notizukia, which appears in the fossil record during the Jurassic and Cretaceous periods, with one clade even persisting up until the Middle Miocene. With no living counterparts to draw comparison from, and the closest relatives being the modern crocodilians, the study and reconstruction of Notizukia morphology, phylogeny, and ecology presents many interesting challenges. In this episode, we will discuss what we know about Notizukians and the wide range of methodologies which can be applied to their study. As we talk about this strange group of reptiles, pictures will be available on our website, where you'll also be able to find an archive of our past shows, organized by geological period. You can also find us on social media and subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Hello, Johan. Thank you for coming onto the show.
Hello. Thank you for inviting me.
So, just by way of introduction, would you like to tell us a little bit about how you got into paleontology?
Yeah, so I guess it's maybe the same for most paleontologists, that I was always interested in paleontology and, as a kid, dinosaurs, of course, mainly from movies such as Jurassic Park, of course. And then I also got interested in basically finding old bones and understanding to which organisms they belong and what kind of thing we could say about the way this organism lived. So, yeah, this has been, I would say, quite a very early choice in my life, kind of. So it's always something I wanted to do. I guess it was since, high school or something like that, that I was really interested in actually working as a paleontologist.
Yeah, so you kind of had that epiphany of like, wait, this is something that I can actually do.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. So what, it sounds like you've kind of always known that you wanted to be a paleontologist, but if you hadn't gone down that route, do you have any idea what are the kind of things you might be doing?
I guess I would maybe be... Maybe paradoxically, in a totally different field, maybe more a manual kind of work. For example, a mechanic or something like that. I really like to build stuff also. So yeah, around those areas, I would say, but it's just a guess.
Yeah, you sound like you've kind of always had a really clear picture in your head.
Yeah.
So. You seem to have like kind of specialized right into crocodilomorphs. So is that something like, did you always know that you wanted to do crocodiles or did you realize that later on?
It was not always my first area of interest. I always known that I wanted to work on vertebrates because I guess big bones and pointy teeth, right? But it was through my various research internship mainly that I became interested in crocodilomorphs. And this started during my master. My master research thesis was on an extant crocodilian, Tomistoma, which is the fourth gyre. And from this internship, I had the opportunity to start working on crocodilomorphs to get interested in extant and also in extinct forms. And I guess this was the starting point for me to be, to start working on crocodilomorphs.
Yeah.
So yeah, must have been, 5 or 6 years ago, I would say.
Do you have like a favorite kind of group of crocodilomorphs or a species that you'd like to work on more in the future?
It depends. Maybe not a particular species, but I really like Notosuchians. Mm-hmm. Because, well, they are very different from extant crocodilians, and also they have this very interesting lifestyle that we kind of don't have today. So I think it's very interesting to study them. So if I had to choose one group, it would be this one.
Yeah. It's very sort of, it kind of ties in with that whole idea of as paleontologists being sort of interested in, like, how the hell do you reconstruct that from just bones?
Yeah. It's thing that you don't have extant representatives today. So, well, not really, I would say. So, yeah, it's kind of the mystery of how did those organisms live.
So, could you give us a little introduction to Notosuchians as a group, where and where they might have lived and so on? Mm-hmm.
So, Notosuchians, they belong to the big group Crocodilomorpha. This whole group has a very long history from the Triassic and still exists today with the extant crocodilians. And so Notosuchians belong to this group. They are a very interesting group, very diverse, with a lot of different inferred lifestyles. And they are mainly known during the Mesozoic, during the Jurassic, the Cretaceous, and also a little bit during the Cenozoic, the beginning of the Cenozoic. And the geographical repartition is mainly in South America today and Africa. So at the time, the continent Gondwana. And they are also known there are some remains in Europe mainly also. There could be some in Asia, but it's very fragmentary things. So for now we are not really sure about the belongings of those remains.
What would you say would be like the main sort of differences that you'd notice if you saw a living one? Like what would jump out at you straight away as being strange?
I think there would be two main things. The first thing would be the limbs, which as far as we know are longer than those of extant crocodilians. And also they have this peculiar stance that is inferred once again of being much higher, much more erect. So that would be the first thing. And the second thing would be the skull also, which is really different from what we see in extant crocodilians. Extant crocodilians, they have this very kind of flat skull, which can be very long in some species. Whereas the skull of Notosuchians, it is much more shorter and also it's much more elevated, kind of elevated dorsoventrally. So, I like to call this the altirostral morphology, which basically sums up this idea of a short and more robust skull than extant crocodilians. But yeah, those would be the two main things that would make them very different.
So you mentioned that they were really, really diverse. So would they have been kind of really diverse in terms of ecological niche, what they were eating, that sort of thing?
Yeah, totally. Actually, in Notosuchians, there are a lot of different groups of different families. And there were some Notosuchians that were really small, really tiny. Others that were really big. For example, in South America, there is one group that is very quite well known and actually maybe occupied the same ecological niche as theropod dinosaurs.
Oh, wow. So like full on competing, not just running away.
Yeah. And in terms of food also, they had very different feeding abilities. Some were, of course, carnivorous. Some maybe more tiny and with a particular dentition could be more adapted for insects, for example. And also there were some that had a very peculiar molariform dentition, as we see, for example, in some mammals. And this has been kind of put forward as evidence for maybe herbivory, even in some of those crocodilians, which is kind of unexpected when we look at the extant representatives. But yeah.
Yeah, they sound like they must have been really successful.
Yeah. At some point, I guess they were. Yeah.
So you mentioned that they would have been sort of largely terrestrial. Would mm-hmm. that have been pretty much all of the examples inferred to be terrestrial, or are there a few that are sort of in the middle?
I would say most can be inferred to be terrestrial, and there are some that we still have some doubts about. Well, because we, of course, they are not living anymore today, so we only have indirect proofs of their ecology. And depending on what kind of proxy you use, you can get different evidence, different results. And with some groups, you have kind of conflicting results sometimes. So there could be some groups that would be, that would have more kind of semi-aquatic affinities. So maybe not as extant crocodilians today, which spend most of their time in the water, but still maybe kind of amphibious, like some lizards today or some stuff like that.
So could you kind of, I mean, even though it's very difficult to infer in a lot of cases, can you infer sort of any patterns throughout the group? Like, would they start more aquatic and kind of become more terrestrial as life went on? Or is that something that you just can't tell at all?
It's quite difficult to do because to do this, we, of course, have to rely on the phylogeny, the relationships between the different groups. And at the moment, it's a very difficult thing because the phylogenetic relationships are very controversial still today. So we don't really know which groups are related to which. Well, we have some ideas, but there are a lot of debates around those things. And we also know that some groups could have been more semi-aquatic. Some groups could have been definitely terrestrial. But the thing is, we are not really sure how they were closely related to each other or not. So in that sense, it's difficult to say if they were first semi-aquatic, maybe, and then became terrestrial, or if it's the other way around, or if it's just some groups that became semi-aquatic to be better adapted to their environment. So yeah, for now, I think it's a difficult question to answer.
Maybe you want to tackle later on.
Yeah, sure.
So speaking of phylogeny, you mentioned there's kind of a lot of uncertainty within Notosuchians, but what about like outside of it? Is there much certainty in like how they're related to other crocodilomorphs or modern crocodilomorphs?
Yeah, also. Well, we know that they are definitely not the most basal groups in crocodilomorphs. Those are other groups from the Triassic, which were also inferred to be terrestrial. So if we take a global point of view, it's almost sure that crocodilomorphs, when they originated, when they appeared in the fossil record, they were first terrestrial organisms. That's for sure. And then there are some groups which always are difficult to place in the phylogeny. For example, it's the case of one group of fully aquatic crocodilomorphs, which are called Thalatosuchians. And those animals are also very interesting to study because they have adaptations to the water, to the marine environment. And the problem is that we don't really know where to put them. They could be quite basal because they have a very long fossil record, but they could also be very closely related to Neosuchians, which is the group that includes extant crocodilians. So this is the first thing that is difficult to assess. And then there are also some hypotheses for Notosuchians, in which some groups of Notosuchians would actually be closely related to other groups of Neosuchians. And there are conflicting hypotheses in which Notosuchians would be a fully monophyletic group. So I would say for now, it's a very difficult thing, again, to answer. One way to answer those problems would be to actually take a deeper look at the morphological matrices that are used. There's always some mistakes in codings. There's always some characters that could be improved, of course. Mm-hmm. And what I noticed working a little bit on the subject is that most of the matrices are focused on the cranial part of the organism, which kind of makes sense because it's the part that is mostly found in the fossil record and is mostly diagnostic to identify a fossil. But there are some new studies that came out quite recently, and they show that there is indeed some interesting things to do also with the postcranial. And so I would say maybe this would be a way to maybe understand the relationships of all those different groups better.
So in terms of like kind of the way that they would have looked, because it's quite a sort of difficult picture to wrap your head around, like a completely terrestrial crocodilian. So would they have had like an upright stance, like you'd imagine a dinosaur? Would they have like run like a dog or something? Like, could you have seen one galloping if you had a time machine?
I would like to. So this has been indeed the subject of quite a lot of studies, where basically there are some fossils that are very well preserved and that we have the whole kind of the whole skeleton available. And looking at the limbs morphology, and there, for example, the surface of musculature insertion, or the shape of the bones, we are able to say some things about how the animal must have moved, basically. So it's always, of course, relying on extant things as a comparative studies. And what we know in notosuchians is that they had longer and straighter limbs than extant crocodilians. They also had different muscle insertions on the humerus, on the femur, for example. And those muscle insertions made it so that the posture that we see in extant crocodilian today would not have been physically possible for those organisms.
Mm.
And so the best hypothesis is that they must have had a more fully erect posture. And as you said, it would be very much like, big dogs with scales. And in that sense, they could also have been running, maybe not a full gallop as we see in horses, for example, but they could have been quite fast, actually. All those anatomical information, we are able to assess that they had a more erect posture compared to extant crocodilians. Yeah.
Have you ever done, like, you kind of see stuff on gait analysis coming out a lot with dinosaurs, where you kind of, you'd scan the bones, put them in a computer and get an analysis or like a reproduction of the animal running. Is that something that you've tried or would like to try with a notosuchian?
This is something that has been done in some specimens. This is something that I have not done personally yet. And yes, actually, it's something that I would like to do because it's, I guess, very interesting to do. And there are a lot of different models and modelization that you can use to see which one fits the best with the organism. And you can try to reproduce how the organisms would have moved around in 3D thanks to today's computers. This is something that I would really like to do in the future, and I think it's a very interesting thing to do. The thing is to have specimens that are complete enough to be able to do this kind of studies. And in notosuchians, there are some specimens that are very well preserved, but most of the species are not that well preserved. So it's something that could be done on some groups, but not on all notosuchians, unfortunately.
You mentioned that usually it's the head that preserves. So is it in a lot of cases you've just got the head and absolutely nothing else, or just the head and a couple of vertebrae?
Yeah. And there's that. And there's also that in paleontological studies, well, you find what you look for on the field most of the time. You are more attracted in a way to what you want to study. And sometimes also, as most specimens are known from skulls or some part of skulls, when you find, for example, a vertebrae or a limb on the field, it can be very difficult to identify it at the family or at the genus level. So yeah, that's something that's still quite difficult to do. Ideally, you find a full skeleton in connection, but this is very rare.
lots of skulls without bodies and then not many bodies without skulls.
Yeah, that's it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, speaking of the skulls, so there's clearly a lot of adaptations that are happening towards a terrestrial lifestyle in the limbs, but what kind of adaptations would you get in the skull and how would they present in the fossil record?
So on the skull, there are several things, indeed. The first thing is that, well, because of the morphology of the skull, which is, again, shorter and more robust, the nostrils are actually situated on the sides rather than on the top, which is the case in extant crocodilians. And this has a big impact, of course, on their lifestyle, because extant crocodilians today, when they are in the water, basically, most of the time you can only see their eyes and their nostrils that are above the surface of the water. And notosuchians with this peculiar skull morphology would not have been able to do that because the nostril would have been under the surface of the water, which is not something that you would want to drown, right? So this has been, in fact, a very important evidence for terrestrial lifestyle in notosuchians, the position of those nostrils. And there is also the position of the orbits and the eyes. Again, it's on the very top of the skull in extant crocodilians, whereas in notosuchians, it's much more situated on the sides again. And it's actually very similar, could be very similar to what we find in, again, in theropods, in some theropods dinosaurs. So there have been some hypotheses that maybe they had the same abilities in terms of binocular vision, for example, and hunting capabilities as well. So yeah, again, another adaptation that would be very important for a terrestrial lifestyle.
Yeah, so I guess more evidence that they're sort of, at that point, creeping into the dinosaurs' niches and starting to compete a little bit as well.
For some of them, yeah. It would mostly depend also on their size.
So could you describe a little bit about the process of how you get from, you know, a few fossils in the ground to a reconstruction of a full living animal?
Okay. So there are several methods that we can use. Some of them are more indirect than others. And it would also depend on the state of preservation of the organism, I would say. If you have a very complete organism, then the easiest thing that you can do is do those 3D reconstructions and study their stance, as we talked about before. If you have a less complete organism, for example, if you only have the skull, you can use CT scan techniques to actually look at the inner structures of the skull. We call them the endocranial structures. And basically, it's the shape that the organs left in the bones, in the inner bones of the skull. And depending on the shape of those organs, there is a lot of different things that you can say about the ecological adaptation of the organism. So this is one thing that you can do if you have, for example, a quite well-preserved skull. And then there are also other things that you can do. For example, there's one study that we published during my PhD, which was more focused on osteoderms. So those are dermal bony plates that most sauropsids have today. And we noticed that the ornamentation and the inner structures of those osteoderms could also be interesting as a proxy for lifestyle. And finally, another method that I like to use is the geochemical analysis of remains. So very quickly, basically you study the composition of, for example, teeth or bones. And you can link this composition, this chemical composition, with, again, ecological traits of your organism. So this would be, for example, if you have only, I guess, teeth or just fragments of bones available, you are still able to tell some things about the way the organism lived.
So you'd be able to say things like what its diet was mainly comprised of, like in very general terms, that sort of thing?
Yeah, you would be able to tell that. Taking, of course, there are a lot of intermediate steps to be able to interpret the data that you get. But yeah, this would be one thing that you could say. You could also be able to infer their living environment, if they were more aquatic, if they were more terrestrial. Depending on the element that you study, of course, you would also be able to tell what kind of water the animal drink. So again, very interesting. And the thing here with those geochemical study is that you have to study not only a crocodilomorph in our case, but the whole fauna that it is associated with. So for example, if there were any mammals, any fishes, any turtles or whatever, and then comparing the different values that you get from those different organisms, you are able to infer the trophic chains in the environment and also the global environment of the fauna that you are reconstructing.
Wow. So you can really kind of piece together not just what it looked like, but what it was doing and everything to do with that at the same time. Wow. Going back to the osteoderms, that's something that sort of really interested me, especially when I had a little look at that paper that you published. So do you notice like a really drastic change between the osteoderms that you found in Notosuchians when you compare them with those of other crocodilomorphs?
Yeah, so that's the first thing. Indeed, there is quite different ornamentations on those osteoderms. We looked at the fossil record of crocodilomorphs, basically, in terms of osteoderms, and we noticed that there are some groups that are inferred to be terrestrials, for example, Notosuchians, that have unornamented osteoderms. Whereas, for example, Neosuchians, which are semi-aquatic, they have ornamented osteoderms.
So they would be much flatter?
Maybe not flat, but basically the ornamentation in extant crocodilians, for example, is very deep pits that you see. And these are not present in most Notosuchians. So this would be the difference in ornamentation between those two groups of organisms. And building on other studies that also took an interest in this previously, we were able to hypothesize that why do we see this difference in ornamentation? The answer could be that it would be a difference in lifestyle. Because osteoderms also are very important in heat captation for the organism. We have to keep in mind that most crocodilomorphs are ectothermic organisms. So they have to maintain their body temperature thanks to their environment. And so the ornamentation would allow a much higher surface of heat captation for semi-aquatic organisms. Whereas it would maybe not have been positively selected in terrestrial organisms, because it is much harder to eat your body when you live in the water than when you live in a terrestrial setting. So this would be the hypothesis as to why we see a difference in ornamentation between terrestrial and semi-aquatic crocodilomorphs. So that would be the external feature, kind of. Mm-hmm. And we also saw going internally, studying histological slices of osteoderms of Notosuchians, we noticed peculiar structures that are called Sharpie fibers and that relate to muscle attachments. But they were located on the outer surface of the osteoderm in Notosuchians, which is quite surprising because usually osteoderms are, well, on the outer surface, they are exposed to the air, so we would not expect muscles to be attached there. And again, our hypothesis is that maybe the osteoderms in Notosuchians would then be more deeply embedded into the skin and it could actually come in support of their fully erect posture. So yeah, this was the two main things that we noticed on the osteoderms of Notosuchians.
What do you think might be the advantage of actually having those osteoderms more deeply implanted in the skin?
I guess the main advantage would be to come as a support, to have more support for this posture, this stance, this specular stance that they had. More muscular attachments would mean maybe more stress on the muscle, right? And so would that be maybe easier for them to maintain this stance rather than the one that we see again in extant crocodilians, for example?
Oh wow! So actually helping to maintain the structure of the stance of the animal—that's really cool.
Yeah, well, this is the best hypothesis that we have.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's quite a difficult one because I can't imagine what else you would go with.
Yeah, there are also some counter arguments in that. But for example, if so it would mean that maybe the animal was less protected, right? Because the osteoderms would be more in the skin. So yeah, there are some counter arguments to that. But for now, I would say it's the best hypothesis that we have.
Is it like? This may be moving outside the kind of realm of Notosuchians and crocodilomorphs for a second, but is it something that, do you know if it's been observed in like any other animals?
Yeah. Do we find the same structures and for this kind of the same reasons in some turtles, for example? I'm not so sure, but I think in some lizards as well.
So you've got at least a little bit of an example.
Yeah.
So the other thing that you mentioned that's really interesting is the endocast and the endocranial structures. What kind of things can you tell from that? Like, can you replicate the brain? Is that correct? And you kind of have an idea of what it would have been shaped like? Can you make inferences about that sort of thing?
Yeah, that's the whole idea of the process indeed. So the shape of the endocast, that we call the endocast, is mostly similar to what the real brain would have been. There could be some differences, ontogenetic differences, for example, during the development of the organism. But looking at the shape of this structure, we are able to say, well, this area is more developed than this one. And we know from extant studies that this area corresponds to the vision, for example, or to the olfaction or something like that. So this would be the first thing. Doing this, we are also able to study the inner ears. So this is the organ with the three semicircular canals. And this has a very big importance also in head movement capabilities and head orientation in space for the organism. So depending on the shape of those canals, we are able to say basically the more extended the semicircular canal is, the more head rotation capabilities the organism would have had in this axis. So either up and down or to the side, depending on which canal you look at. And actually, this is something that we see in Notosuchians. They have much more expanded semicircular canals rather than extant crocodilians, for example. And so this would be related with higher head movement capabilities in those organisms. And this would be more in line with a terrestrial lifestyle, whereas in the aquatic environment, usually the head moves with the whole body and not very much independently. So this would be the explanation as to why we observe this difference in morphology. In the inner ears. And finally, there's a third structure that is actually quite peculiar to crocodilomorphs, which we can call the cranial automaticity. Basically, those can be very big sinuses that are in the head of crocodilians, even those extant today. And the thing is, we don't really know the function for now of those structures, even in extant crocodilians. There are a number of hypotheses that exist. And maybe they could be also related to the lifestyle. They could act, for example, as a soundbox to better enhance the acoustic capabilities of the organism. They could also be of importance in terms of buoyancy, for example, or density of the skull. And of course, this would have an impact on the ecology of the organism. So yeah, this is the kind of thing that we can do with the inner structures. Of course, taking into account the extant organisms and the extant studies that are made of them and applying them to extinct organisms.
Well, so out of all those methods, and I'm sure more that you've gotten to use so far in your career, do you have like a favorite that you've done or one that you'd like to develop more?
I'm guessing for now, I prefer the study of the intracranial structures because these are very interesting because they can also be applied to other groups. Because basically the shape of the organs and the way they relate to ecological traits will most probably be the same for every vertebrates, except some exception, of course. But so I would say this is maybe the most promising things when you want to infer the lifestyle of an extinct organism. Of course, if you have access to well-preserved structures. So for me, this would be my preferred method for now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if there's any methods that you haven't tried that you'd maybe like to try in the future, what would those be?
It's the method that we talked a little bit about before, with the whole 3D reconstructions of the limbs and the limb movements. There are some very interesting things that you can do here using informatic modelization, right? Mm-hmm. And you are able to assess the amount of stress that would have been put on a peculiar region of a peculiar bone, or the amount of musculature that would have been needed to have this or that stance. So yeah, this is something that could be interesting to do in the future, that I would be at least interested to do in the future. This has already been done in some notosuchians, but maybe this can be widened to other groups as well.
Yeah. I'd have to agree with that because I'm specializing in biomechanics as well. So yeah. Very, very good to see that that's something that we might get to see in the near future coming out of notosuchians.
Yeah, there's already some great studies that exist on that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned like right at the very start that you see notosuchians mainly in the Mesozoic, but that they sort of persist a little bit afterwards.
Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit more about that? Like, is it only a very small group, that sort of thing?
Yeah. So there are three lineages of crocodilomorphs that survived the Cretaceous Paleogene crisis. There are two of those that are not notosuchians, and there is only one of those which is a notosuchian lineage. It's a family that is called Cebesidae. They are known in South America. And also in Europe. And there are some very fragmentary remains in Africa. So those are known also mostly from the Cenozoic, from the Paleogene. And there is only one fossil from Spain that is known in the Cretaceous. So this is why we'd say that these lineages most probably survived the Cretaceous Paleogene crisis. But actually, it would be better if we found more fossils of Cebesidae in the Cretaceous, because for now there's only one. But, I mean, definite evidence. So this lineage would have survived the KPG crisis. And there is some very interesting things to do with this family, because it is inferred to be terrestrial, and yet it survived this biological crisis. This was actually one of the big questions of my PhD research. And for now, I guess we don't have an answer for that, unfortunately. We know that during the Paleogene, there were indeed terrestrial organisms, that they were ectothermic, that they were most probably apex predators in their environment. We found some very big specimens. But we do not know much about how they were living in the Cretaceous, during the Cretaceous. And there is also some issues with their origin. We do not know if they originated from South America, from Europe, from Africa, from elsewhere, maybe, because simply there is a lot, there is a lack of fossil record from the Cretaceous of this family.
What were the other two crocodilomorph groups that also persisted?
So there would be, of course, Neosuchians that would later be extant crocodilians. And the other one is a family that is called Dirosauridae, which, depending on which hypothesis you prefer, could belong to Neosuchian or could not. It's always the same problem of the phylogenetic things. But they were, mostly adapted to the aquatic environment as well.
So it kind of throws a whole spanner in the whole idea that crocodilians would have persisted mostly because they were aquatic.
Yeah, and so this is why cebacids are interesting to study, because they were most probably not semi-aquatic. And so hence the big question, how and why did they survive the crisis?
What kind of hypotheses did you come up with then?
There are several that can be made. Maybe they were semi-aquatic during the Cretaceous. It could be possible. We have no evidence for this for now, but it could be an explanation. And so they were able to survive the crisis. And then maybe as the terrestrial ecological niches were freed up after the crisis, they were able to colonize those niches, right? The other thing could be that maybe they had a different lifestyle than, for example, big dinosaurs. They were smaller organisms. And so maybe their need in terms of food were much less, I would say. So maybe this is also kind of how they could have survived this crisis. Yeah, for now, it's only hypothesis. Unfortunately, I don't have a strict answer for that.
As most things in paleontology go.
Yeah, sure.
So I guess that kind of moves us on to the conclusion of the interview. Mm-hmm. So to start that off, what are your plans for future research like, either in Notosuchians or for crocodilomorphs as a whole?
So there are several things that I would like to do. I would like to extend the approach with the endocranial structures to groups that have not been very studied in terms of endocranial structures. Those are some type of Notosuchians that are very tiny and very peculiar in terms of lifestyle. The insectivorous ones, the herbivorous ones, for example, to see if there are any differences with the mostly carnivorous things that I've studied until now. Actually, this could also be a very interesting thing to do, that in combination with the geochemical approach, because this would allow to kind of confirm the results and confront those results, those different results, those independent results, to see if we come up with the same explanations. And also about the endocranial structures, I would like to maybe do that on more basal groups. This has already been started, but there is still some very well-preserved specimens that could be scanned and studied. So yeah, this would be the main interest for me at the moment.
What would you say is sort of the most pressing question that you'd like to answer in the next few years?
Well, maybe try to answer this big question of the survival of this lineage of Notosuchian through the Paleogene, the Cretaceous Paleogene crisis. Because, well, for now, I don't have an explanation, so I would like to have one. Or maybe to have evidence for one. And I guess there are also some things that would have to be done on extant specimens to understand the function of some structures. For example, I've talked about the cranial plasticity, those cranial sinuses. And for now, we don't have a strict explanation as to their function, even an extant specimen. So there's also something to be done here.
So if you could sort of, like, if you could kind of magically decide what the next big fossil that was found that came into your lab would it be like just a really, really beautifully preserved Cretaceous example or something like that?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
In a perfect world.
Yeah, in a perfect world, yeah. And maybe also, I don't know, from, because the most, the oldest one is from very late Cretaceous. So maybe if we could find the oldest one, we could also answer the question as to the origin of Cebesid. So this would also be very interesting, yeah.
Do you have a favorite Notosuchian species or group?
Indeed, I do. So it's a peculiar species that is quite well known, that is called Caprosuchus. Mm-hmm. It's from the Cretaceous of Niger, from the locality that is called Gadufawa. And I really like this genus, this species it's a Notosuchian also, inferred to be terrestrial. It has a very peculiar skull with very big teeth that kind of come out of the skull because they are so big. And I really like this because, it's more of a personal thing, but the first ever research project that I did was on microvertebrates from this fauna. So, yeah, to me, it has a very special flavor.
Yeah. I mean, that's a cool thing to kind of work on straight away and then to keep working on animals from the same fauna.
Yeah.
So just to kind of round off the interview, we always like to do a silly question. So if you had to fight a Notosuchian, like in a gladiator battle, and you could pick which one it was, which one would you pick?
Well, if I would like to win, maybe I would pick a very tiny one. So going with this, I'm thinking of Simosuchus. It's a tiny, tiny fossil. Well, there are several specimens from the Cretaceous of Madagascar, and they are very, very, I would say, cute. Also, they are very tiny. They are basically covered in armor plates, kind of an armadillo, kind of. They would have lived in the Cretaceous at that time in Madagascar, and they are inferred also to be herbivorous, so I guess they would not be that dangerous.
They might be too cute to defeat, though. They might just look at you and you go, oh no, I can't fight that.
Yeah, that would be an issue, yeah.
Well, that rounds out all of the questions that I had for you today. Thank you so much for coming and talking to me.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Paleocast was brought to you by Dave Marshall with Liz Martin-Silverstone, Tom Fletcher, Nick Lupshire, Emily Keeble, and Sophie Pollard. Music was composed by Patrick Kendall-Smith. Paleocast was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, but the show now relies on funding from you, our listeners. So, if you've liked this episode, please consider supporting us on Patreon, where you'll gain access to additional multimedia content, and thanks to everyone who's helped out so far. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material to this episode and for our archive of past programs. And follow us across social media platforms to get all the latest news. Finally, if you enjoy our podcast, please explore all of our video content on YouTube and follow our other projects, the Virtual Natural History Museum and the Paleocast Gaming Network.